morning, a federal judge says Elon Musk and Doge likely violated the Constitution when they gutted USAID. But with most of its contracts already stopped, what's next for the agency? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, Israel says the ceasefire in Gaza is over after it killed more than 400 in attacks targeting Hamas. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We ask a former Palestinian peace negotiator what options are left for the people of Gaza. Also, how doctors who mail abortion pills are reacting to Louisiana's criminal case against a New York doctor and the health impacts of living in extreme heat. It's Wednesday, March 19th. Today in 1995, Michael Jordan ended his first NBA retirement by going back to the Chicago Bulls. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A federal judge in San Francisco is questioning whether the Trump administration is complying with his order to reinstate certain fired government workers. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports this judge's order covered six federal agencies.
U.S. District Judge William Alsup said he'd seen media reports that federal agencies had rehired probationary employees fired last month, but immediately put them on paid administrative leave. He said that was not allowed under his preliminary injunction, because government services wouldn't be restored if people aren't working. Attorneys for the government did not deny that agencies have placed reinstated employees on leave, but called it an intermediate measure, a first step to getting people fully reinstated. They did not say what the next steps would be or if they'd be carried out while the government appeals the judge's ruling. Several federal employees told NPR they are getting paid but have gotten no news about going back to work. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
A separate federal judge has given the Justice Department another deadline. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg is questioning the Trump administration's use of a rarely used wartime power to deport hundreds of Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador last weekend. The judge ordered the administration not to use the wartime power for the deportations and to even turn the planes back if necessary. But that didn't happen. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran says Boasberg then told the Justice Department to explain what happened.
Judge Boasberg asked the Trump administration to answer four detailed questions about the deportation flights. The administration partially complied. The DOJ provided a sworn declaration that no one was deported after Judge Boasberg's written order was removed under the Alien Enemies Act.
NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reporting. But Judge Boasberg wants many more details about the deportation flights. He's ordered another response, and it's due by midday today. He wants to know when the flights left U.S. airspace and when they landed in El Salvador. Officials in Ukraine say there have been numerous Russian airstrikes overnight, including attacks that hit two hospitals in northern Ukraine. This comes after President Trump and Russian President Putin said they'd agree to start talks toward a ceasefire in Russia's war in Ukraine. But NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Ukrainians are skeptical of this.
President Putin told President Trump Russia would stop targeting energy facilities, but Ukrainian officials say a major transformer in eastern Ukraine has been hit, and drones continued to attack Ukraine's cities, including the capital, Kyiv. It is these nighttime attacks by Russia that are destroying the country's energy sector, infrastructure, and the normal life of Ukrainians, said Zelensky. And the fact that this night was no exception shows that Ukraine must continue to put pressure on Russia if it wants peace. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Israel's prime minister says any further talks for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas will only take place under fire. Israel has resumed bombing Gaza in an effort to pressure Hamas to release more Israeli hostages. More than 400 Palestinians have been killed and hundreds of others wounded in the sudden resumption of fighting. Hamas says it is committed to the original ceasefire that it struck with Israel. In the U.S., federal health officials say there are more than 300 confirmed measles cases. Most of them are in Texas. Texas Public Radio's Gabriel Alcorto Solorio has more.
Of the nearly 280 confirmed cases, two are in vaccinated people. The rest of the patients are not, or their status is unknown. Dr. Michael Chang, a Houston pediatric infectious disease specialist, spoke during a Children at Risk press conference last week on the misconceptions for measles treatment.
I want to emphasize there's no antiviral treatment for measles, and vitamin A is not an antiviral. So while vitamin A has shown some mortality and morbidity benefits in malnourished children, its role in healthy children is not clear.
Chang added that vitamin A in high dosages can lead to serious toxicity, and the only way to prevent measles is to be vaccinated. I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
The National Weather Service is warning that gusty winds and dry conditions could spark wildfires across several states from Texas to West Virginia. Wind gusts could hit 50 miles per hour in parts of west central Texas. Most of that state is under a red flag warning. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
In 1913, Olive Fremstad, one of the golden voices at New York's Metropolitan Opera, and Willa Cather, a writer from McClure's magazine with two novels under her belt, sat down for an interview that Cather would turn into a profile for McClure's magazine at the end of that year. The child of an unwed Swedish mother, Olive Fremstad was adopted by an American couple and grew up in St. Peter, Minnesota, singing and playing organ for her father's revival meetings. She ran away from Minnesota to become an opera singer in New York, debuting there in 1903. To prepare for her role in Salome, she actually visited a morgue to heft a real decapitated head. A year after that interview, Olive Fremstad was out of a job, giving her final operatic performance in Minneapolis in 1918. In 1915, Willa Cather published The Song of the Lark, her third novel, about a Midwestern girl who pursues a singing career. A novel that some believe was inspired in part by Olive Fremstad.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In a few minutes, what options do the people of Gaza have now that the ceasefire is over? But first,
a federal judge has ruled that Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency likely violated the Constitution when they effectively shut down the U.S. Agency for International Development.
But President Trump is promising to appeal the decision, calling the judge rogue for interfering in DOJ's efforts to effectively shut down USAID. For the past 6 weeks, the Trump administration has been dismantling the agency. It's now a shadow of its former self.
Here to tell us more about what this new court decision means for the administration and for USAID, we're joined now by NPR's Fatma Tanis. So tell us about the case that prompted this ruling.
So a couple dozen USAID employees and contractors sued Elon Musk and DOGE, saying that their actions to dismantle the agency were reckless, they were done in a slash-and-burn manner, and that Musk and DOGE didn't have the authority because Musk is not an appointed agency head who wasn't confirmed by the Senate. Now, this case is one of several other ongoing lawsuits around the dismantling of USAID, and it stands out because it directly sued Elon Musk and DOGE, whereas other lawsuits have named President Trump and senior officials as well. The defense argued that Musk and DOGE were only advising USAID officials and that the agency's leaders were actually responsible for what happened.
Yeah, but the judge disagreed.
Yeah, he didn't buy it. Judge Theodore Chuang wrote a 68-page opinion detailing why. He said that the evidence showed that, quote, Musk made the decisions to shut down USAID's headquarters and website, even though he lacked the authority to make that decision. He said that Musk and DOGE team members likely violated the Constitution in multiple ways and deprived Congress of its authority to decide what to do with an agency that it created.
Okay, so what does this all mean now for USAID?
Well, there's not really much left of USAID. Most of its contracts have been terminated. The staff have been whittled down to just a couple of hundred people. Now, the judge has blocked Musk from any further steps to shut down USAID, and he ordered Doge to reinstate access for current staff to emails and other electronic systems. But the impact of this ruling is quite minimal. It won't restore the work that the agency was doing before all of this. Humanitarian and development assistance programs, for example, are still cut.
Okay, now what kind of reaction have you heard from this?
Well, people who are critical of Elon Musk and Doge are saying that this is a big deal because there are concerns about what Musk and his team are doing across the federal government and what their authority is. And they say that the administration has been sending mixed messages. For example, President Trump has publicly praised Musk as he and his team gut federal agencies. Trump has said Musk is doing an unbelievable job to eliminate waste and improve efficiency. But in these lawsuits, we're hearing something else. Government lawyers are saying that Musk is not in charge, that he's only there in an advisory role. Now, NPR reached out to the White House to get more clarity on this, but we have not heard back from them. And Norm Eisen, who leads the group representing the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, called the ruling an important victory against Elon Musk and his attack not only on USAID, but the U.S. government and the Constitution, he said. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, President Trump weighed in yesterday and said, quote, "I guarantee you we will be appealing." So there's going to be more news to follow on this case.
Yeah, more than likely. That's NPR's Fatma Tennis. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Israeli airstrikes are continuing today in Gaza after Israel broke the ceasefire yesterday.
It was one of the deadliest days of the entire Gaza war, with more than 400 killed. Those included five Hamas officials and women and children killed in their homes overnight. Israel says it wants Hamas to agree to a new ceasefire deal and release more hostages, but Hamas hasn't changed its position. And many in the Israeli public are opposed to the return to war.
So why is Israel doing it? NPR's Daniel Estrin is on the line from Tel Aviv with new details this morning about the attack. Daniel, so this was a surprise attack. So explain how it all came about.
Well, a senior Hamas official told us that mediators were actually holding ceasefire talks with Hamas in the wee hours of the morning Tuesday when these surprise Israeli strikes began. And an Israeli official tells us deception was the point. It began around 2:10 in the morning. Israel launched its first strikes, took about 10 minutes. This happened after weeks of preparations. These plans were kept inside a closed circle of the Israeli military. And it came as a surprise to many Israelis and the public, too. Many recently freed hostages spoke out yesterday about this return to war. We counted more than half of the living Israeli hostages recently freed by Hamas said the move endangered the lives of other hostages still in Gaza.
What is Israel's rationale for doing this, for deceiving Hamas and launching this surprise attack?
Well, the old ceasefire deal was struck under the Biden administration, and Israel sees itself as having leeway to try to extract new ceasefire terms under President Trump. That's exactly what Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, tried to do. He presented a proposal last week for new ceasefire terms for Hamas to release more hostages before the talks to end the war began. And Israel said it's returning to war now to pressure Hamas to agree to those terms.
And how is Hamas responding to that pressure?
Well, a Hamas official tells us that the group's main demands still remain. And those main demands are to go back to the original terms of the deal brokered under Biden and to begin discussing the permanent end of the war. You have to understand, A, that in recent months, aid supplies were surging back to Gaza under the ceasefire. And Hamas was beginning to recover. And Israel saw that Hamas was benefiting from the lack of war and from talks continuing in recent weeks without giving up more hostages. And so here we are.
Yeah. So, but how does this move, Daniel, maybe benefit Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu politically inside Israel?
It does benefit him politically because he has this deadline. He has to pass a national budget in 2 weeks or his government could collapse. And so returning to war allows him to convince his far-right ally, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to rejoin the coalition now. It strengthens his coalition. He can support a new budget. It allows Netanyahu to distract from a move he tried to fire his domestic security chief, which is sparking street protests. We could see this round of strikes in Gaza lasting another couple weeks until Netanyahu can pass a budget and until he has more flexibility to maybe resume a ceasefire then.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, we appreciate all of your reporting on this. Thanks.
You're welcome, eh?
For more on what comes next for Palestinians in Gaza, we're joined by Diana Boutou. She is a human rights lawyer and former Palestinian peace negotiator. Diana, good morning and welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with why. Why did the diplomatic effort to get this ceasefire extended or moved to a second phase fail?
Because there was never really any diplomatic efforts to have a ceasefire in the first place. All that we really saw was that there were demands, but there wasn't really any follow through, even though the three phases of the agreement were supposed to be matched by and followed up with by the United States and by Qatar, as well as Egypt. We didn't really see that any of these countries were getting involved, particularly when things were going sideways. In particular, when we saw that Israel was not allowing caravans in, when they had reneged on allowing in humanitarian aid, there wasn't anybody who was standing for and saying to the Israelis, enough is enough. We have to continue to push ahead with this agreement. So while there was a push to have an agreement, there really wasn't any diplomatic effort to see that this agreement goes to its plays its course out.
Now, the U.S. blames Hamas for this resumption of violence, saying if the group just released the hostages, all of this ends. So will Hamas do that, especially given Israel consulted with the U.S. when they carried out these surprise attacks in the midst of negotiations?
This is exactly the problem, is that the agreement calls for three separate phases. And in those three separate phases, you have the exchange of Israelis in exchange for Palestinians who are being held in Israeli prisons being released, as well as a surge of humanitarian supplies, as well as Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. What the Trump administration was seeking to do was to bypass all of that and to just focus on the Israelis and not at all focus on Palestinians, Palestinian prisoners, Palestinian hostages, the humanitarian supplies, as well as Israel's withdrawal. And so obviously, when you just have the United States siding, very powerful party, siding with Israel, yet another powerful party, it's not at all surprising that Israel used this opportunity and said, now that they have the full backing of President Trump, who's also sent in weapons, that they can go ahead and bomb Gaza overnight, which they have since done. This is the largest bombing that we've seen in over 18 months.
Now, what does this mean then overall for the future of Palestinians and their quest for sovereignty, really?
I'm very worried because we're now on day 17 with no humanitarian supplies getting into the Gaza Strip. That means no food, no fuel, no water. And Israel's made it clear that they're going to continue to, as they put it, negotiate under fire. And so the options are very, very limited for Palestinians. This is why I believe that this shouldn't have been a negotiation between Israel and Hamas. It should have been a much broader picture with the entire world getting involved. The idea that people who are living under occupation have to negotiate with their occupier is repugnant. It doesn't fly in the face of international law. And yet here's something that has been demanded of Palestinians throughout their entire history. I think we have to change the equation now. It's now time to be putting pressure on Israel to allow Palestinians to live. Otherwise, I'm really worried about what the consequences are going to be for a continued genocide.
When you say the consequences, and just for context, Israel denies it's a genocide. When you say the consequences, what are the consequences you're worried about?
I'm specifically worried about people dying. We've already seen that the healthcare system is completely dilapidated. People are not living in homes, they're living in tents. And when you don't see any future, you can see that there's just going to be either ethnic cleansing or a continuation of this genocide.
Human rights lawyer Diana Boutou, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. At the world's largest refugee camp in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, most people live in makeshift housing built from bamboo and plastic tarps. These shelters are often damaged or destroyed during monsoons, which are intensifying as the climate warms. And they get very hot during heat waves.
As those houses have poor ventilation, the people living there were suffering from respiratory disease frequently, but also suffering from heat-related illnesses in summers.
That's Farzana Jahan of the International Center for Diarrheal Disease Research in Bangladesh. As part of a pilot project, her group built six houses using a sturdy, lightweight material called jutin instead. It's made from jute, a natural fiber that's cheap and abundant in Bangladesh. In the first year, the jutin houses stayed cooler in the summer and withstood the monsoon winds and rain. Jahan says safer, more comfortable housing not only leads to improvements in residents' physical health,
but also in mental health, which is very important because they are people who are already traumatized.
So these materials could be an affordable way to create more climate-resilient housing for some of the world's most vulnerable people. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump's plan for mass deportations depends a lot on whether local police and jails will cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In most states, that decision is local. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, cities and counties are having to juggle legal risk with potential reward.
If you're a mayor or a sheriff right now, you're facing a tough call. Republicans say you have a legal duty to help ICE, while Democrats warn that if you help ICE the wrong way, you could get sued. That's what happened to Suffolk County on New York's Long Island.
It was a little surprising because what we were doing was just honoring a warrant like we do with any other jurisdiction.
That's Errol Toulon Jr., the Suffolk sheriff. His county was hit with a lawsuit on behalf of more than 600 people, which the jail held at the request of ICE between 2014 and 2018. The court found that the county didn't have the right to hold them past their normal release dates, just to make it easier for ICE to pick them up on immigration charges. Suffolk is now looking at a $60 million judgment. The county will appeal, but Toulon says the jail will no longer honor ICE warrants unless they're signed by a judge. An administrative warrant signed just by an ICE employee won't be good enough.
I do think that we need to tread lightly because taxpayers can't afford more litigation and more judgments.
In recent years, lower courts have been skeptical of jails that hold people for ICE without a judicial warrant. Of course, ICE itself can still arrest people on immigration charges, and that opens the door to a different approach.
We are going to cross-designate and embed Nassau County Police Detectives with ICE.
That's Bruce Blakeman, executive of Nassau County, also on Long Island, announcing in February that he would sign up 10 of his detectives to act as ICE agents. He said they wouldn't be doing basic immigration enforcement, but Nassau Police Commissioner Patrick Ryder said it was possible that they would make immigration arrests during operations against, say, criminal gangs.
Those 10 detectives have the same power as ICE, working with ICE. They go out and they assist ICE in these targeted enforcements. If there are people in those targeted enforcements that are illegally in that house with that MS-13 gangbanger and their name is checked, yes, we will be detaining them along with ICE.
And when local police act as ICE, there's an added perk for local law enforcement, extra power to hold people in jail. In New York, local prosecutors often complain that judges release too many criminal defendants pre-trial under the state's bail reform law. Rafael Mangual works on policing at the Manhattan Institute. He says ICE-designated detectives offer the option of rerouting a criminal suspect into the immigration system.
You're basically guaranteeing detention of someone that you know has committed a crime. Whereas if you process those individuals through the state criminal justice system, they'd almost certainly be back out on the street within hours of their arrest.
Nassau officials stress that their detectives will focus only on alleged criminal migrants. But that doesn't reassure Javier Guzman. He's Colombian and works with a nonprofit called Make the Road.
I'm an immigration organizer. Do you think I can tell people, yeah, if you got into some trouble, call the police? I cannot do that because we don't know who's going to show up.
But if you talk to people outside the Ideal Food Basket, a grocery store popular with migrants in Nassau, there's not quite so much foreboding. Yvette, we're using just her first name because she doesn't want to identify herself to ICE, says she has heard about the 10 deputized Nassau detectives on the news. Yes, it's a little frightening, but what else can you do but trust them a little, that they do their job and don't harm people, especially working people, she says. And if she had a problem, would she call the police? She says she'd have to think about it, but if it were something serious, she would still call the police. The Trump administration is pushing for ICE cross designation around the country. Immigration enforcement experts say this kind of task force approach is likely the only way to achieve the president's promise of mass deportations. But it's an approach that also takes time to set up. ICE is supposed to train local police first, and several jurisdictions are still waiting for that training. Nassau County has been waiting for 6 weeks. NPR reached out to ICE about the program, but got no response. Martin Costi, NPR News, Nassau County, New York.
Lady Gaga's Mayhem is a return to the pop music that made her famous, and it just debuted at number one. Here's Stephen Thompson of NPR Music.
Lady Gaga has kept busy in the 5 years since her last full-blown pop album, Chromatica. She starred in a doomed Joker sequel, released two Joker spin-off albums, mostly standards. She got nominated for an Oscar, not for the Joker movie, and released a second Grammy-winning album of duets with Tony Bennett. All that work served to both keep Gaga in the public eye and ramp up anticipation for her return to maximalist pop form. Mayhem is Gaga's 11th album to hit the top 10, dating back to her 2008 debut, The Fame. Seven of those albums topped the charts. Die With a Smile, her duet with Bruno Mars, has been riding high on the singles chart for months now. It remains at number two. Another 9 songs from the album also charted this week. Mayhem's streaming numbers are the biggest of the superstar's career so far, which bodes well for Lady Gaga's chances of sticking around on the charts for a while. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
This is NPR News.
In 2022, the Chinese government told NPR's Emily Fang she was no longer welcome in China, where she had lived and reported for 7 years. Even so, she says she hasn't lost claim to her Chinese identity.
Being Chinese is not confined to the boundaries of the People's Republic of China.
I'm Elsa Chang. My conversation with NPR's Emily Fang on her new book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology. KAXE KBXE's annual Record Store Day sale is Saturday, April 12th at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. We are accepting gently loved vinyl donations through March 28th at our studios in either Grand Rapids or Bemidji during business hours. The Bemidji Public Library and Lake Bemidji State Park present a recipe swap and discussion of the Good Berry Cookbook Saturday, March 22nd at 2 p.m. at the library. The state park's artists and residents will assist in decorating recipes as well. The Beltrami Master Gardeners will be at the Bemidji Senior Center Friday, March 21st at 1 p.m., sharing garden tips and presentations. Great River Rescue has their annual Fur Bowl Sunday, March 23rd from 1 to 3 at Bemidji Bowl. Individuals and teams may register at greatriverrescue.com. The City of Grand Rapids holds City Government Academy, a 9-week program that explores different aspects of the city, like public works, community development, and more. Registration deadline is March 21st. Find more info at cityofgrandrapidsmn.com. The Sustainable Sheep and Fiber Community of Northern Minnesota has a gathering at the Clearwater Life Center in Gonvick, Friday, March 21st from 1 to 3. Learn some fiber art or share your latest projects. All are welcome. Northern Lights Opera Company holds auditions for their summer musical, Once Upon a Mattress, Friday, March 21st at 6 p.m. and Saturday, March 22nd at 1 p.m. at the Park Rapids Armory Arts and Events Center. Find more info at northernlightsopera.org. Bill Jameson will visit the Brainerd Public Library Monday, March 31st at 1 p.m., sharing stories and songs from the lumberjack era.
On today's date, March 19th in the year 2001, I find my first active spider in a mailbox. The spiders are quick to respond to the heat that forms on the mailboxes, and especially the darker mailboxes. Sun will shine on them, and the spiders that have been hiding in the crevices or overwintering as eggs hatch, and the spiders emerge, and once again, they begin their summer of fighting and hiding and attacking insects as they come around the mailboxes. In one case, I remember seeing two spiders in a mailbox, one fairly large and one much smaller. And the chances there are that we are looking at a male and a female. Female spiders are typically much larger than males, sometimes 10 times larger. And these spiders are very active come spring and hungry and ready to start a new family. So males and females find one another, mate, and the process begins again.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. New research shows what living in extreme heat does to our bodies, and it's not good. A study in the journal Science Advances says living through lots of hot days really adds up. NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports.
Every year, heat waves send people to the hospital for short-term sicknesses like heat stroke. But doctors also know that heat exposure is linked with long-term health problems like worsened heart disease. Eunyoung Che is a researcher at the University of Southern California. She led the new research, and she says heat waves
could actually be taking a silent toll at the cellular or the molecular level in our body.
So that's what she and her colleagues looked for, evidence that living through prolonged heat affected people's DNA.
DNA is fixed at birth. We can never change our DNA.
But DNA can be modified. That happens through a process called methylation.
DNA methylation acts like a light switch for genes, so it can turn them on and off.
Scientists often use methylation as a marker of biological age. Researchers call it epigenetic aging.
We know that some people seem to age faster than others, and that's because biological aging doesn't always match chronological aging.
Epigenetic aging can happen because of a poor diet or not enough exercise.
It is highly responsive to environmental exposures like stress, pollution, and in this case, heat.
Jay and her colleagues figured out that there's a big epigenetic difference between people who lived in places with 90 degree plus days for nearly half the year, think Phoenix, than in cooler places like Seattle. Lots of heat exposure over several years added up to about 14 months of extra epigenetic aging.
That means you're going to start to get, you know, early symptoms of dementia and diabetes and all these other health conditions about a year and 2 months earlier.
That's Deborah Carr. She's a gerontologist at Boston University who wasn't involved in the research.
To lay people, that might not seem like that much, but if that's something that takes you out of the workforce for a year, that makes you go to the doctors every day for a year, that increases your medication budget, right? It really can have tremendous impacts for older adults.
In fact, it's a health cost comparable to smoking. Tom Clanton is a physiologist at the University of Florida who wasn't involved in the research. He previously looked at how heat exposure affects mouse genetics. In mice and humans, it's clear that heat exposure can have long-term impacts, like heart disease later in life. And this work, he says, starts to map out exactly why.
You sort of accelerated your way towards, you know, an old heart, an old vulnerable heart.
Carr says you can think of it another way, too. If every older person living in a really hot part of the country is prematurely aging, that adds up to an enormous cost. It's economic cost to families. It's a hit to the healthcare system. And it's people just feeling poorly before their time. And heat is only getting worse. Human-caused climate change could add an extra month of extreme heat to most parts of the U.S. in coming decades. Alejandra Barunda, NPR News.
Some U.S. doctors say they are increasingly afraid after a doctor in New York was indicted for mailing abortion pills to a woman in Louisiana. Louisiana officials have demanded the doctor's extradition to face charges. New York has refused. As Rosemary Westwood from member station WWNO in New Orleans reports, the case has raised the stakes for providing abortion care across state lines.
This is the first time criminal charges have been brought against a doctor for mailing abortion medications. After the news broke, staff at a reproductive health clinic in Maine became anxious. They also ship pills to patients in other states.
It just hit home that this is real. Like this could happen to anybody at any time now, which is scary.
Dr. Kohar Dersermonian is the clinic's medical director, but she reminded her staff that they knew a case like this was coming.
We didn't know how or to who or what charges, right? But we knew that this was going to happen.
To protect their doctors, New York, Maine, and six other states have passed laws that block extradition in such cases. But this will be the first test of these shield laws. Dersermonian says the indictment reminded her of the risks to her clinic and herself.
But still something I'm willing to continue to do because it's what's right.
Telemedicine is now playing a critical role in abortion access. In states with bans on abortion, more than 7,000 people a month are ordering pills to end their pregnancies, and demand is growing. Take the Massachusetts Medication Abortion Access Project. Last year, the clinic mailed pills to nearly 500 patients a month. Now, they're shipping to 3,000 a month. Angel Foster directs the clinic and says the indictment will not stop them.
It has not changed our practice. It has not changed our intention to continue to practice.
Foster has four doctors on staff and is hiring a fifth. She says they've created an organizational structure to spread out the liability.
The person who orders the pills is different than the person who prescribes the pills, is different from the person who ships the pills.
Doctors who prescribe under shield laws may be protected from prosecution in their home states. But if they travel to other states, they lose that protection. Julie F.K. is a human rights lawyer who helps doctors open telemedicine abortion practices. She says they know if they do this work, there are some parts of the country they shouldn't go.
There's really a commitment not to visit those banned and restricted states. We didn't have anybody going to the Super Bowl or Mardi Gras or anything like that. And I've talked to doctors where it's not a good fit because they have an elderly parent in Florida or a college student somewhere or family in the South.
If the New York doctor is convicted, she could face up to 5 years in prison. Liz Merle is Louisiana's attorney general. Speaking to Fox 8 News in New Orleans, she criticized New York for refusing to extradite the doctor. Dr. Samantha Glass works in New York. She thinks some doctors will stop mailing pills because of the increased scrutiny and fear. But Glass believes abortion should be as accessible as any other health care, and she's planning on joining a New York practice that sends pills across state lines.
Someone has to do it, so why wouldn't it be me? I just think, you know, access to this care is such a life-saving thing for so many people that I just couldn't turn my back on it.
New York shield law has protected the doctor so far. But legal experts say if Louisiana is determined, they could take their fight to federal court. For NPR News, I'm Rosemary Westwood in New Orleans.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with WWNO and KFF Health News. This is NPR News.
Area Voices, we're trying to discover what makes an artist, what drives them, what inspires them, and most importantly, why it's important to keep creating.
Theater, in particular, is an art form that sort of asks for people to test the borders and find out what people are excited about and what people are interested in, but also to challenge audience members.
I think every artist wants to show a feeling of some sort. I think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, art, I don't know anything about it. It's not my thing, and I can't critique something because I don't know anything about it. I think that's wrong. I think you're either touched by a work of art or you're not. You like it or you don't like it. And I think when somebody paints with passion, that's what they're trying to convey, is a mood, a feeling.
Tune in Wednesdays on The Morning Show to hear more Area Voices.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And Amé Martinez. Two astronauts are back on Earth after what was supposed to be a week aboard the International Space Station turned into 9 months. The manager of NASA's Commercial Crew Program said yesterday that Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore looked very healthy after their capsule splashed down. But what happens to the body and mind after that much time in space on astronauts? Here to answer that question, we've called up Jack Fisher. He's a former NASA astronaut who spent more than 100 days in space. Also had a couple of spacewalks, Jack. So tell us about that feeling of landing back on Earth after spending that much time in orbit.
Yeah, thanks, Abe. Man, it's a bit provocative. You turn off and start ignoring your equilibrium and your vestibular while you're in orbit because it just doesn't work. And then all of a sudden you come back in, the chutes pop, and you start rocking around like a crazy roller coaster ride. It gets pretty provocative. I landed in a Soyuz on land.
Oh, wow.
A little bit harder of a pop once you land, but then it stops. And for Sonny and Butch and Nick and Alexander, landing in the water, it's a little bit smoother in that first. You know, as you hit, it gives a little more, but then you kind of rock. And so all of that to say that it's not the most fun thing you'll ever do, but yeah. It's worth it to come home and get back to your families.
I mean, can you have like a beer right away if you wanted to?
You know, you could, and you know, I landed basically in Russia, so I'm not going to say that no alcohol was involved in the filming, but it's maybe not highly suggested because you're pretty much already 3 margaritas in. Your body is very dehydrated.
Yeah.
The vestibular being the way it is, you're just kind of off balance. So definitely not recommended.
So how long before you found, say, your Earth legs? How long before you felt like sturdy and connected to the planet?
Yeah, you know, it took about a few days to a week. And it's a bit different for everybody. And then the big thing is your flexibility. It's really awful when you're on orbit, and you come back and all of a sudden your leg weighs 30 pounds again. So you have to work on that. Strength is pretty good, but it'll take you a good month before you're up to full fighting form.
Does your body get a little taller being in space?
Oh my gosh, it does. I'm 5'11", and I was over 6 foot for the first time ever. I was 6'1", and I'm an old fighter pilot, desk pilot, so my back is all messed up. I felt great. I was taller. I get off the plane. I go into the doctor the next day. He's like, how tall are you? I'm like, I am 6'1". Thank you very much. And he looks at me, and he's like, yeah, let's measure. And I had already lost it.
Oh.
So it was like a day. I was taller for a day.
I would just keep saying 6'1". I would just keep lying about it.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, Real quick, I mean, so like in the days after, so you're taking a stroll in the evening and you see the night sky. Do you ever look up and go, oh, I was just there?
Yeah.
Did you miss it?
Absolutely. The just watching the space station cross overhead, it's part of you. It becomes part of you. You miss it. And what an incredible experience. It's great to have Butch and Sonny and Nick and Alexander home.
Jack Fisher is a former astronaut with NASA. Jack, thanks a lot for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Thanks so much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson, and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates, and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today. Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234.
On first, it may be private equity.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Commvault. When companies face ransomware and outages, they can recover data and business in just minutes with Commvault.
I'm David Brancaccio. The San Francisco Giants are selling a 10% stake to a private equity firm. It's now all major sport leagues in the U.S. that allow those institutional firms to buy pieces of teams. Marketplace's Henry Epp has more on how watching pro games now is also like watching private equity in action.
Historically, major sports teams in the U.S. have each been owned by one really rich person or family. And the only way for them to cash in on their investment has been to sell the whole team. But as the value of sports teams has risen, Tim Koba at High Point University says owners have realized that selling off part of their stake in a team
is a way for existing owners to capitalize on the rising valuations of their clubs.
And right now, private equity firms are willing buyers.
Essentially, they're buying into people's passions.
Stefan Szymański is at the University of Michigan. Because fans are so passionate about their teams, they're willing to sink a lot of money into watching and supporting them. And private equity, Szymański says, sees a revenue opportunity.
What they're trying to do is try and ways to extract more of the financial value of that happiness from the fans.
By raising ticket prices, he says, or finding new ways to reach and charge fans through digital channels. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
The private equity company buying 10% of the Giants is Sixth Street, which has far-flung investments, but in sports has previously bought into the San Antonio Spurs, and it became the first institutional firm to be majority owner of a team, Women's Soccer's Bay FC. Numbers S&P futures are up 0.3% now. The 10-year interest rate is at 4.29%, slightly lower than this time yesterday, with the Federal Reserve briefing on interest rates, growth versus recession, and jobs coming about 7 hours from now. We're also covering the Trump administration revamping the boards of the two firms that back about half the mortgages in America, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These have been under government control since the great financial crisis, but could eventually change. Marketplace Morning Report podcast. We'll have that later on.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Lisa. Lisa mattresses are designed and assembled in America. Plus, Lisa donates thousands of mattresses a year to shelters and those in need. LEESA.com. And by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what small businesses need.
The boss sent me to the rodeo in search of business stories. It's part of our ongoing series on what we can learn from humans doing commerce face-to-face in such an otherwise digital economy. Today, tricks of the retail trade from the pros at the vast livestock show and rodeo going on now in Texas. Here at the NRG Center in Houston, live bovines and, sure, manure. A t-shirt for sale depicts five cows with the words, "Smells of money." The retail selling floor next to the livestock judging pasture is heavy gauge. Cattle handling hardware, 900-degree home pizza ovens, and Western hats of felt from Pelt. Joe Young is selling hats and realigning the ones customers bring by.
You want to have a little bit of dip in the front. It's kind of that howdy man dip. If it's flat, it can pick it up and just blow it right off the top of your head.
I came to Joe's booth, called Heads or Tails, out of Haskell, Texas, equipped with my own wool Stetson, which never did come with an owner's manual.
If you just swear to throw it in your back seat, it's not going to stay shaped very well. So if you set it on your dash or in your passenger seat upside down, that would be the best way of keeping it so it holds its shape.
I don't know his sales, but a rival vendor lets on that 300 hats a day fly off the shelves over there with not even a sales pitch. Here, the shaping is what they call in retail a loss leader.
It gets busy. All 8 of these steamers will just be blowing steam all day on a weekend especially. Pretty Marlboro man looking right there.
Yeah, no one has ever mistaken me for the Marlboro man. They might have mistaken you for the Marlboro
man. We can give it a shot.
Now, the key hat trick of the trade, the X factor. A 10X hat is plenty serviceable, but 100X should be better armor against the elements.
So, like, 10X would probably be around about a 10% beaver, and a 100X hat would be pure beaver.
A 1000X Western hat costs thousands and might have mink or chinchilla in the mix with diamond accents, less for trail riding and more for picking up Vocalist of the Year at the CMA Awards. I'm more of a 10X man.
Still a good quality hat. It's a $400 hat. They hold their shape well. I just wouldn't go out in a torrential rainstorm.
For a hat that's more, I don't know, vegan, there's Ginger Joe's booth, Family Jewels of Texas. She's got hats woven mainly of palm, all customized, none identical.
Turquoise and spiny oyster and coral. We put sterling silver conchos on them.
Ginger Joe's trick of the trade is about the efficiency of what business geeks call just-in-time inventory.
I mean, if I didn't go home and make hats in the morning and the night, we wouldn't have any more left.
Back to Cowhide at a business called Our Stuff. Shanna Saunders, proprietor. She's selling easy chairs and sofas made in Leveland, Texas.
That one's a leather made out of Tiffany blue with a cowhide on the sides. It's kind of got that old San Francisco gunslinger day kind of look.
Rodeo priced at $3,500, which seems a steal for real leather America made. But do people actually buy big ticket here versus just stopping at one of the few places to sit down on the selling floor? Shanna answers this way.
People don't realize this booth right here costs $28,000 to rent this space right here.
She's smiling, which says to me her revenue by week 2 here is well past her break even.
People come in, they'll go home and measure. Sometimes the sale comes afterwards, but some people are drunk and put their credit card out.
I guess you can get beer right over yonder.
I mean, the alcohol does help.
What I'm seeing is not the typical theme park style throwaway dreck. Several families I meet here tell me they had bought their spiffy headgear at the rodeo years earlier, suggesting the merch is an investment that holds up. This young fellow, Daniel Clark, is here with his mom.
It has red feathers, 2 on the sides of the hat, and it kind of looks like a taco, but a bit smaller. Yeah, it didn't fall apart because it's good quality.
Later this week, hear what lambs and goats tell us about setting prices through an auction. And you can decide if I look like a poser in that, Stetson, by checking out our videos on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Our handle is MarketplaceAPM. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Looking at weather today, partly sunny skies, highs in the mid-30s, breezy north winds, 10 to 20 miles per hour, gusts getting up to 30, evening lows tonight, 23 to 29 degrees. And don't forget, we have our question of the week. Tell us about a time luck was on your side. You can text us at 218-326-1234. KXE tells the stories of northern Minnesota, and we are looking for your stories. Have you been impacted by federal funding freezes or job cuts? Email news at kaxe.org or text 218